This is Mae Brussel. This is side two of broadcast number 692. The program is titled World Watchers. It's March 11th, 1985, and I'm going particularly slowly on the details of these articles because I did so much work previously on the Korean Airline, and as I said before, with the lawsuit coming up, we're going to get more views on this particular event. I just want to make a few more comments on the investigative work of Anthony Sampson, well-known London investigator and author, talking about our president of the United States. This is coming from Der Spiegel in Germany and from London, and he's describing what happened when the Korean airline went down. He said what followed was a high-level telephone conversation by virtually every important administration head, then National Security Advisor William Clark, Presidential Assistant Edwin Meese, CIA Director William Casey, Secretary of State George Shultz, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Lawrence Eagleburger, as well as Burt. Now, Lawrence Eagleburger is the chairman of Kissinger Associates, that floating public relations firm that takes the expert Kissinger all around the world with various clients and monarchies and multinational corporations. He's just the floating Defense Department, the ambassador at large for the repressive dope dealers and murderers that are described as black. I call them the black fascist power people. This is the way they behave and use power. And Mr. Eagleburger was the Kissinger-Kramer representative right there, right in the White House, carrying on before he left that position then to work for Kissinger Associates. According to Der Spiegel, the meeting made a decision to use the incident as a way to crush the European peace movement by showing how bad the Soviets were. Now, they couldn't orchestrate this in 2 or 3 hours. This had to be well planned, and I knew it was by the editorials that came down, how well they were written by the next morning's press. They were to crush the peace movement by proving how bad, of course, the Soviets were. As Burt reportedly remarked during the conference, it was also decided to float the false story that they landed safe at Sukhalin Island. The reason for that, the letter, was not only to buy time, but to make it appear as if the U.S. was unaware of their flight. The phony story and the lost hour have been long interested those who followed the tale of the Korean airline. The airliner was shot down at 3:38 a.m., The event was not only picked up by the Japanese at Misswa, but by a host of United States intelligence listening devices in the area. And this article goes on to say that the CIA had information and they had meetings and along with Tokyo and our Central Intelligence Agency and with Seoul, South Korea, they decided to leak the story that the plane had landed safely. Well, Jesse Helms had arrived at Seoul, South Korea, and of course the Korean CIA is our CIA. So in collusion, the whole story from the Japanese point of view or the Korean and the American CIA was to stall for time and act as if they didn't know anything going on. This article in Der Spiegel says there are also indications that the fate of the 007 was well known at the highest levels of the Japanese government, according to one highly placed source in the Nakasone administration. When the Korean Foreign Ministry released the story about the plane being safe, Japan's chief cabinet secretary laughed at the report and said, "Someone is trying to control the news." The fake story kept the ball rolling, giving the United States time to check the Japanese tapes with their own, and now you see our tapes are destroyed. As soon as this comes out, this story came out November 24th, 1984, just at the end of the last year, 3 months ago. So when the trial begins, no tapes, sorry, we don't have any tapes. And according to Anthony Sampson, that kept the story going while they figured out, I guess, what to do. The Der Spiegel article will be a hard one for the administration to answer because Sampson is an extremely well-known journalist. And then it goes on to say much of the material in Der Spiegel article, as well in the LA Weekly, is said to be from sources uncovered by the 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Seymour Hersh, who also knows about Henry Kissinger. And that he naturally, this article doesn't mention Henry Kissinger. I just put that in. I asked Seymour Hersh, and I might have mentioned it to you, about the possibility that that airplane was down to make a martyr of Larry McDonald, and for a lot of other reasons, such as stopping his testifying regarding Western Goals. He was chairman of the Western Goals, with their computer into the Los Angeles Police Department and other police departments around the country. And Seymour Hersh was outraged. Oh, of course they couldn't do anything like that, just as they wouldn't blow up Dorothy Hunt on the plane to keep the stories of Watergate from being told or from the president being blackmailed. One of the interesting things about that manual, that CIA manual that was written for controlling countries or taking them over or keeping the native population under your thumb, has sections that pertain to events that are happening to us, because I consider us a conquered country since World War II, and that the intelligence community treats us that way. And one point they have in their directions, and these directions were written at the time of the Vietnam War and the South Korean War. They've admitted to the Vietnam, so I'm sure the same people had it going back much earlier when they tried out their muscle after Nazi Germany with the Korean and then the Vietnam War. I imagine it was written by Edward Lansdale, or people have suggested in various articles it was, on counterinsurgency. But in one paragraph, it tells how to hold established citizens. It's titled, Established Citizens, Subjective Internal Control. Established citizens such as doctors, lawyers, businessmen, landholders, minor state officials will be recruited to the movement and used for subjective internal control of groups and associations to which they belong or may belong. And this is true not only of landholders or doctors or lawyers, but we have journalists. I think there were 400 at the time of Watergate that worked for the intelligence community in some capacity. So they control what various writers say. In other words, they can tell you part of the story. Just say Mark Lane can tell about the grassy knoll regarding the Kennedy assassination, but they can't go beyond. And certain people can write and get books published, major publishers, on little pieces of the puzzle, but they know when to stop, that you don't go any further. And if it's going to come out anyway, they'll acknowledge it that far. So I think that Seymour Hersh is the kind of person that will put a control on anybody who comes up with such an outrageous idea, when it actually is the only explanation for what happened and why he traveled alone and all the other members of his party, Larry McDonald's party of 36, all went on another airplane. Now, off to another subject, which also touches on Henry Kissinger. Every news event does, and I think I'll just have to remind ourselves of that as we bring up these various items because of the plans to get that constitutional convention going. This is one I had 3 years ago in my files, and see how it pertains to what's going on the borders of Cambodia and Vietnam today. NBC had a full 5 days segment on the refugees in Vietnam and the placement of where the former policemen or officers are kept until they are psychologically restructured. And there's fear that if they're allowed to come to the United States, they want to start the war over again. So this story is very pertinent to what I saw on NBC. And Robert Keith Gray is the public relations man for NBC Broadcasting. And this Mr. Alpert had gone over and done these very pathetic segments of these particular families who are broken up. And there is a new bill being put before Congress now to open up all immigration to anti-communists. If you're an anti-communist, you can come into this country. And that's why this particular article is pertinent for right now. Exiled force waiting to return to homeland. This is Premier Key. Says the Vietnamese are training in the United States to liberate his homeland. And this is in Tokyo in 1982. He had a press conference. Since that time, he's been identified by Judge Kaufman's committee as being part of the large organized crime syndicate in Orange County, but it is the mafia drug money that keeps the weapons going so nicely, greasing the guns. But anyway, this is in Tokyo. Exiled South Vietnamese Vice President Nguyen Khai Ky, that's the fellow who loved Adolf Hitler so much he had pictures of him around, said Wednesday he and other former fighting men are training in the United States in preparation for their armed struggle against the communists and the regime in their homeland. Ky appealed to the United States and other Western nations to back a coalition of anti-communists from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos to help liberate ourselves from the Vietnamese communists. The flamboyant ex-fighter pilot, who's living in Orange County for the last 7 years, said that the overseas Vietnamese community financed military training in the United States. They are training camps and programs for Vietnamese in the United States today, and we do it ourselves. He made these remarks at a luncheon speech for 200 members of the Foreign Correspondents Club in Japan, and he indicated that he and other former South Vietnamese military men are conducting their training on public property in the United States. See, once Ronald Reagan took the oath of office in January of 81, then these guys could go around traveling and be arming and be assured that if they're anti-communist, William Casey and Vernon Walters and the whole gang will make sure that they go back and start the whole thing over again. He said he uses public property, the so-called national parks in America. He said, they're the best places for military training. He predicted a military role for the Vietnamese anti-communists would develop soon, prompted by resistance efforts in Cambodia. Former head of state Prince Sihanouk had formed a coalition of his own followers, the Khmer Rouge forces of ousted leader Pol Pot. And it goes on to say that Ronald Reagan, it refers to Ronald Reagan being the president now, and I assure you that they will listen to our cause with very friendly reception. Well, you know John Singlau, but the World Anti-Communist League and Reverend Moon and Chiang Kai-shek's family, so strong over in Taiwan, they're all listening and helping him. He said, we accept former Liberation Front communists to fight with us. We would accept them, he said. Additional recruits would come from Vietnamese refugees throughout the world, and 100,000 or so still in the refugee camps in Thailand. Key, 52, runs a liquor store in Norwalk, said he's becoming increasingly active in efforts to return to Vietnam, and he's been in regular contact with resistance groups inside that country and in the United States for the last 14 months, and he used the occasion of speaking to a large group of journalists to tell them that he's training in the United States and setting up these various activities, and that's why you see so much of it in the news. In case you wondered where it was coming from, there was an article recently about Ronald Reagan's stepping up covert action all over the world. Well, Premier Key is directing it from the national parks in California. Now, Congressman Edwards wrote a very important editorial for the San Jose Mercury, and it wasn't a syndicated story on the wire services, and I don't know how many of you saw it. He formerly was in the FBI. He's a member of Congress in California. Congress must reckon and take control over the war-making policies. You may have seen something similar to this in some of your newspapers. This is what Don Edwards said. Speaking before the National Press Club in December, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger listed six criteria that should be present before the United States troops are committed to combat. Shockingly, nowhere in Weinberger's laundry list was a requirement of congressional approval, the condition considered most essential by our founding fathers and emphatically imposed in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Congress was mentioned Weinberger's fifth requirement in passing. He said, there must be some reasonable assurance that we will have the support of the people and their elected officials in Congress. Some reasonable assurance, a show of hand. Caspar Weinberger, a member of the Black Fascist Power Group, that he wants to declare this kind of activity, and they have completely bypassed he and Kissinger, the Constitution, the entire War Department, has something holier that only can be explained, not as that religious prophecy, the Armageddon necessarily, and I want to get into that with Reagan, but the Black Fascist Power, the desire for vengeance to kill, and Reagan has an absolute necessity for the Star Wars, even ill-advised and expensive, and the threat it'll bring, the Star Wars operation, and he's going to overthrow Nicaragua. No matter what the Congress says, he has to do it. It's a compulsion that is based not on a religious belief that can be reasoned out or felt, but more having to do with Black Fascist Power and the descriptions that Nietzsche has of what the kind of person is like who has that kind of power. Now, Congressman Edwards is worried about this and the fact that the Constitution, he says, is explicit. And the history of the Constitutional Convention and the Federalist Papers makes it clear that Congress alone is authorized to decide when and if we go to war. The earliest U.S. Supreme Court recognized Congress as the sole war-making machine, and it goes into the history where time and time again during this century, and since just this time, American presidents have sent U.S. troops into foreign hostilities without prior authorization from Congress. Our forces have been sent into the armed conflicts around the globe, Central America, the Middle East, the Caribbean, the Far East, the most notably the Southeast Asia, all in the name of national interest and all at the individual initiative of the president and all with ex post facto approval of the government body holding the exclusive power to make such commitments. Who was behind all of that in Washington besides pulling those strings, besides Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger, who managed the Central America, now manages it, the Middle East, the Caribbean, the Far East, Southeast Asia, having his hand in every single pie, just like he runs off to India and tells Rashid Gandhi, don't embarrass us and we'll allow you to exist. Congressman Edwards says, in each of these instances of presidential war making, the nation would have benefited by husky debate that prior to congressional approval would have provided. We needed it. In none of these instances would the security of the country have ever been imperiled by that delay required for congressional and public consideration. Today, because Congress has relinquished the war-making power by timid responses and by the enactment of empty war powers resolution, in 1973, Reagan is free to wage war at will. He can bomb or shell friendly nations such as Lebanon. He can invade with foreign mercenaries or mine neutral seas. He can even invade and conquer an independent nation as in Grenada. And I referred to that identical to Hitler's Blitzkrieg, and that's what it was. It was simply a takeover, the black fascist power wanting to have it because I want it. Not that I'll deal with Mr. Bishop, not that Sir Eric Gary is corrupt. The mafia and prostitution and organized crime and what's going on there is bad in some ways. No, we want it, we'll take it. Now, Congressman Edwards says, an American president is now an absolute monarch on all issues of war and peace due to Congress surrendering the war-making decision. In more than 22 years that I have been a member of Congress, I can't find a single example of the where the American people would not have been better off if its presidents had respected the war-making requirements. Now, John Kennedy will have been dead 22 years. It's the 21st year now. And after he was killed, and many researchers, along with me, call that the coup that changed this country. And Congressman Edwards in Washington sees the difference and how they don't want to use this Constitution that was written to protect us. Well, if you have Reinhard Gehlen come in from Hitler's intelligence to run your intelligence community and 3,000 or 4,000 other Nazis, and Fritz Kramer with his monocle comes in and runs is an advisor to the Pentagon, and Henry Kissinger making the major policies in the National Security Council and in the State Department, what do you expect? None of them American-born, Mr. Brzezinski either. What's the Constitution to these people? What does it mean to them? So Congressman Edwards is saying that they're trying to get House Resolution 1304 through Washington now. The existing War Powers Resolution has that fatal flaw that the president alone decides when to go to war. The congressional approval is required only after forces were committed. This provision emasculates Article 1, Section 8, that our troops already are in combat. House Resolution that's coming up, 1304, eliminates this loophole while providing for emergencies. The president can't start a war without consulting Congress and getting approval of a majority vote, and it ensures deep involvement of the American people, of who you send to Congress. This is an emergency situation he's referring to, House Resolution 1304, and you might write to your congressman, and you might even say that Henry Kissinger would be president, or could be, and something terrible would happen. Now, I want to get to a matter that I briefly mentioned at De Anza. The reference for this, it has to do with the Star War Conference, and Daniel Graham, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the partner and in the offices of Fritz Kramer, the mentor of Henry Kissinger, walked out on a meeting that was reported in the Houston Post, I didn't see it in any other paper, regarding the Star Wars intention for a first strike because he was exposed and had to leave the meeting pretending, well, he was good and angry, but he left the meeting, and this is so important with the dialogue of the Star Wars going on now, supposedly to protect us from the Soviet Union, the confrontation between Daniel Graham and various people who were selected to watch the buildup of the Star Wars and have checks and balances on it. Interestingly enough, reported by Roland Evans and Robert Novak in the Houston Post, titled OTA Report, that's the Office of Technology Assessment, could spell big trouble for Star Wars. Well, so far, everything that Reagan has wanted, Reagan has gotten. He, as I say, he's the black fascist power, and he can really get anything he wants because he represents evidently what all those other weaklings, all the people who submit to what he says, give him that power. That's how he has it. He wants the Star Wars, and even though the Houston Post says there could be trouble, there probably won't be, but this is why they bring it up. They said the political battle over President Reagan's strategic defense initiative, known as Star Wars, took a bitter turn. They say this is in the Houston Post in February 28th, just a few weeks ago. It took a bitter turn when one member of the highly placed advisory panel, the Strategic Defense Initiative, the SDI panel, quietly resigned on grounds that Congress and their Office of Technology Assessment was preparing a report that would try to kill, it was designed to kill, the Star Wars proposals. That charge by retired Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, an all-out supporter, he's the one who designed the Star Wars operations, blew the cover off of an intense but unpublicized struggle between the Star Wars backers and the anti-Reaganite Office of Technology Assessment. Now, if you don't think a thing is practical just on the merits of it not being good, then you are an anti-Reaganite and your motives are questioned. Congressional appropriations hold the key to the president's call for a full-scale research effort to explore their defenses against Soviet nuclear missile attack. The study of the Office of Technology Assessment, an arm of Congress that sometimes operates with little visible congressional reign, could go a long way towards setting back the Star Wars proposal on Capitol Hill and set a mood against Reagan's policy. Graham's charge of the Office of Technology Assessment, he says it was prejudiced in drafting its report, due for publication in the spring, was responded to by Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Lugar got into this, and he's not on the 21-member panel, advisory panel, of the Office of Technology Assessment, but he read the report that's coming out, and when Lugar read one portion of the draft of Chapter 3 of the Office of Technology Assessment, there was study suggesting that Reagan's aim may be a reckless U.S. first strike against the Soviet Union. Senator Lugar was stunned. Now, Senator Lugar and Representative Senator D'Amato from New York, I always call them the two senators from the Vatican, very conservative, do everything Reagan wants. They're not anti-Reagan. Just follow what Lugar does. Forget the other one. So when Lugar was absolutely stunned, the way this report was written, you can imagine what was in that report. Graham's resignation from the advisory panel pointed to oversee but not to write the Office of Technology Assessment report. It apparently, when it came out this month, he wanted to oversee it. One reason he gave for the report, the project, Director John H. Gibbons, for getting on the panel in his letter of recognition was the same draft language that offended Lugar. Graham said the language apparently appeared to be concocted in a way to create an a priori case against Star Wars. The language that so surprised Lugar states that a suggested goal for strategic defense is to provide a sufficiently capable defense that the United States can credibly threaten the use of offensive nuclear weapons should it choose. In other words, the draft language written by the staffers hinted that Reagan wants to perfect a nuclear defense and use it to blackmail the Soviet Union and into doing his bidding and accept an American nuclear attack against Moscow, which Moscow could not retaliate if they had this technology going. Lugard told us Reagan is perfectly justified in researching the potential of this strategy, but he was shocked at the draft language that was contained in it. The report that's been drafted up, this early report, contains language and other logic which seems bizarre, according to this story in the Houston Post. Assuming the United States perfected a capable defense of military targets, it says the Soviet would attack in an effort to inflict massive destruction on 75% of our population. The advisory panel includes several experts with strong pro-Star Wars views that wrote up this report, such as retired Air Force Major General John Toomey and its chairman, Dr. Guford Stever, S-T-V-E-R. But also on the panel are anti-Star Wars officials, high officials whose reputations were made decades ago in establishing the strategy of mutual assured destruction. This is described by Jimmy Carter as two scorpions in a bottle, or Ronald Reagan as two scorpions in a bottle. Jimmy Carter, last year authorized the Office of Technology Assessment to write a background paper that infuriated this administration because it derided the Star Wars as the offensive weapon. That underlines General Graham's rationale for resigning for the advisory panel. For Reagan, the resignation is a setback in itself by virtue of Graham's expertise and strong support of the Star Wars. He quickly got off this group when they revealed the role of his little baby that could be used as an offensive first strike, and that is evidently written up in the report. I won't have time to go into this long article on the Star Wars weapons and Daniel Graham, but you can copy it at the library. New York Times, March the 4th, 1985, has a full account of the background of the development of the Star Wars and how the Lawrence Livermore Lab was set up in 1950. That's just when the Cold War was really going to escalate and we were going to war in South Korea. And as soon as Ronald Reagan was governor of California, he went over to the laboratory and already the nucleus for a first strike against the Soviet Union was being put into the hands of the scientists of America, and Ronald Reagan has been part of that from the very beginning. The account tells about the Hertz Foundation in 1940 that was set up, and Dr. Teller draws a lot of his help from there, and that he's on the board of the Hertz Foundation. This was started in 1940 at the time. A lot of people wanted Adolf Hitler to win the war, and when J. Edgar Hoover was vice president of Interpol with Mr. Kaltenbrunner and Heydrich, these horrible Nazis, and our country was working very closely with Adolf Hitler until the time of Pearl Harbor, or actually until the invasion of Poland. On the board of the Hertz Foundation, along with Edward Teller, were such people as J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, General Curtis LeMay, head of the Strategic Air Command, and Herman Kahn of the Hudson Institute. This Star Wars thing has been cooking up for a long time. The Los Angeles Times has a large article. It was a Sunday editorial, February 17, 1985, by Thomas Power, also a well-known author. The layered truth behind the Star Wars. He says, the purpose is not to keep the Soviets from threatening us. The real reasons for spending uncountable billions on space-based defense systems are buried so deep they are practically unconscious. And that is the thing I worry about in watching Reagan operate, or George Shultz or Caspar Weinberger or Mr. Eagleburger or Mr. Byrd and Henry Kissinger. It is in their unconscious, in their really black fascist power trip, that they will do anything. They will strike. They don't care what comes back on us. They don't care about what's polluted the billions of dollars it would take to clean up planet Earth right now. I truly believe that they don't care. There are very good writers exposing the insanity at a very intellectual level and a lot of statistics and the relationship of these people to what they have in mind. But nobody yet has really diagnosed them. I take it back. There is a psychiatrist in L.A. who has diagnosed Reagan as mentally sick. I'll tell you more about that next week or in a few weeks. I met with this doctor. He worked at Menninger's and at Mayo Clinic, and he had was one of the few psychiatrists that ever saw Hess in the Spandau prison in Germany. And the reason I saw him is that he's trying to write a book on the fact that Ronald Reagan, as president, is mentally sick. And if I don't do it next week, I'll share it with you a little later, and I think he'd even let me use his name on the air. I went to see him and talked to him a few months ago. Meanwhile, more about that later. This is Mae Brussel, and we are running out of time, so I'll have to cut it short now. The hour has gone by, and I'll be back with you next week.